Hi there. My name is John Beck, and it's my pleasure to coordinate our daily work, our daily lives here at Michigan State University with my colleague, Kurt Dewhurst, from the museum. I'm going to send around sign-in. There's two or three different sign-in sheets. You only have to sign one, but we'd love to know that you were here. And let me announce that 1 week from today, for those of you who are interested right in this room again, David Hamilton Goland from Governor State University in Illinois will be here to talk about building affirmative action from the ground up, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in the construction industry, basically looking at the impact of the 64 Act, and I'll just send those around if you would take one or just make sure that people get them. The 1964 Civil Rights Act is being celebrated and remembered and, frankly, interrogated in terms of what it means today through a program we have on campus from last Martin Luther King Day through Martin Luther King Day in 2015. It's called Project 6050 for the 60th anniversary of Brown versus School Board and the 50th anniversary of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It's allowed us here on campus to have over 200 events so far, and I believe 17 of them this week, if I remember rightly, that have to do in one way or another with civil rights or human rights. And as we've seen with the continuing arguments about immigration, the continuing situation involving police and youth, as we saw in Ferguson, the continuing situation with women across the world who are enslaved by groups like Boko Haram and ISIS and others, we need to really have a continuing conversation about civil rights and human rights. Today, it's my pleasure to really introduce two of my colleagues who are going to be speaking on the exhibit that is currently downstairs. So we look forward to, if you've not already seen it, there are people in the room who are featured in it, that it would be great if you had an opportunity to check out that exhibit. The talk and the exhibit are of the same name, but I have to tell you that my work with both Ruben Martinez and Daniel Velez Ortiz over the years has been an absolute pleasure. Ruben and I have worked together in relation to various activities that we can co-sponsor either under his auspice that I co-sponsor or under my auspice that he co-sponsors to try to really get the word out and to press very strongly the kinds of important things that were right at the heart of the research of Julian Zamora long ago, which have to really do with the Midwest, with Latinos in the Midwest, with employment, with social welfare, and other things that have to do with Latinos. I'm going to let Ruben and Daniel take over in a moment, but I just have to say the title so that it goes on the recording. We record all of these. We currently have nearly 60 of our brown bag sessions have been recorded and put in the university library. And in the university library, they're available online. So anyone can sit at their home computer anywhere in the world, click on our university library catalog, look up Ruben Martinez or Daniel Velez Ortiz, and this talk will come up on the list, and you can actually listen to it on your home computer. So if you have friends or family that you want to make sure hear this story, do have them do that. So today we're very, very happy to have these two gentlemen talking about the exhibit, talking as well about the overall experience that really created the exhibit, and that is Latino auto workers from the margin to the core. Please welcome to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, Ruben Martinez and Daniel Velez Ortiz.
Thank you very much. It's good to see you here today and to see some new faces and also some familiar faces. It's been one of my goals to stay and keep my name off the internet as much as possible. And I've got another failure here today because of what John just said, but I'm very happy to be able to speak to you about the project that Daniel and I have put together, as well with the help that I've received from many of you. This project really is a project that came into being as we prepared to collaborate on the 25th anniversary of the Julian Zamora Research Institute in early November with the MSU Museum. At the time, Gary Morgan was the director, and I visited with him, and we had a discussion about what we could do to work together. And at the time, they were working on a project which has since then been completed. It's called Resurgent Detroit. It's a beautiful project on what I would call people on the move in Detroit, and lots of beautiful photographs and so forth. And I thought, well, you know, since they're doing an urban project, that probably what we ought to do to complement that is also to focus on the urban experience of Latinos here in Michigan. And of course, Latino auto workers immediately came to mind. The Institute has done a lot of work on farm workers. We continue to do that. But we haven't done as much work on the urban experiences of Latinos. So as a result, we decided to focus on that. Since then, Gary has moved on, and he has been replaced by Laura Helu, who is back here. And immediately when she took office, I visited her and talked to her about the project, and she got on board right away. So I want to thank her for that. But, you know, while the project came to life in terms of interest that I had at that time, you know, this, I just told you how it came to be, it was also born out of ignorance, in the sense that I really did not know that so little work had been done on the experience of Latino workers, Latino auto workers. So when I started looking through the literature, you know, there's some broad social history works that are out there, but none of them really captured the experience of the auto workers themselves. And so really what this project is about is to capture that experience, to both make sense of it and also make it come to life. And that's really what we have been doing with this. The good thing about it was that when I recognized that very little had been done, was to recognize that there are Latino auto workers, retired auto workers, and so forth, who are with us today. And I knew that many of the materials that we would be looking for, beyond the oral history opportunities that could occur with them, were in their basements, in their attics, in trunks, and wherever else they like to store their artifacts as they go through life. And the first thing I did was to contact Ralph Ariano, who is here with us, and Sixto Olivo, whom I've known for a few years, and presented the idea to them. We had, I think, about a 1.5-hour conversation at the time. It took a little bit of discussion to try to tailor the scope of the project and to give it some life as we had that conversation. But they got on board with me, and so that sort of set it in motion. After that, I created a Latino Auto Workers Committee who helped out. And as people learned more and more about it, they began to give me information and access to resources and so forth that they had. So what we know, what have we learned so far? Well, what we know is that Mexican-Americans, who were the initial major group of Latinos in Michigan, have been working in the industry since the early part of the 20th century. We set this at the 1920s because we know that there are some documentations there, but we know that they also had been here probably in the teens and so forth, when we had a wave of Mexican-Americans coming up here, primarily through agriculture, through the demand for labor in World War I, and so forth. And then they were followed later by Puerto Ricanos and Cuban-Americans. We call this moving from the margins to the core because one of the things that is critical here is that in many instances, because they had come up to work in the construction, the tracks, the railroads, the agriculture, and so forth, is that in particular those who moved from the fields to the core of American manufacturing really made an incredible leap in terms of quality of life and all of the things that come with a stable income. But more than that, they also became part of what ultimately became one of the highest paid blue-collar labor forces in the world. Not just in the United States, in the world, right? So it had a tremendous impact. And so one of the things that comes to life in the project is the intergenerational impact of that. It's also important to remember two factors that are occurring. One, industrialization was about economic expansion. And that economic expansion, as you know, continued through at least the 1960s, 1970s, and so forth, as to which we began to have a series of recessions and so forth. But also important, and this is something that hasn't been brought out very often, was the separation that occurred between thinking and doing as a result of Taylorism. Taylorism was a movement at the turn of the 20th century that focused on worker productivity through the most efficient means possible. This is when they conducted time and motion studies so that if a worker was doing something and had to take three steps somewhere, industrial designers, engineers decided that they could make them more efficient if they only took one step instead of three steps and so forth. And then the assembly line came into play and so forth. But also Taylor became aware that it was important to have what he would call management engineers who would then basically capture the knowledge that workers had and then use that as the basis for designing the workplace and so forth. And so ultimately, what we had was a separation between thinking and doing. And that is, workers are to do things, they're not to think about what they're doing, so to speak. In other words, they're not in the design side of it. These management engineers are the ones that do the thinking and so forth. So the separation came along. And that's important because as Latinos came up, and as many of you know, educational achievement was very low at the start of the century. It has remained relatively low in comparison to other groups among Latinos and so forth. So the doing part meant that they could do the work, but they didn't have to be highly educated to think about the work that they were going to do, right? So that's an important factor in terms of what came to play. Ultimately, the experience in the automotive manufacturing sector meant for Latinos, and I think for many others, I mean, they were not the only ones, our focus is on Latinos, meant, you know, the top wages and benefits that we've talked about, but also important leadership opportunities that we're going to bring to life here. And also for the Latino community, it became, you know, within the Latino community itself, became, I think, a sign of status and fit within the larger society. Right, because they compare, you know, the internal reference group is compare themselves to others within their own group, as opposed to always comparing themselves to those who are outside. So today's themes, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the historical background, the context in which all of this occurred, the early years of the UAW and Latino participation, and then what we've called a series of themes in terms of Latino heritage and legacies having to do with the transition into manufacturing. What was it like moving from one sector of the economy into another one, which was vastly different? The bonds and barriers that were experienced, opportunities and identity issues, and then ultimately just a little bit about the leadership roles and how they came to life within those who were participating in the sector. So I'll turn it over to my colleague, Daniel Velez Ortiz. By the way, before we get started, this exhibit involves a series of panels much like this one. This was created and used for the purpose of introducing it to the participants at the 25th anniversary celebration conference of the JSRI about a week and a half ago. Ultimately, this will be, I think, seven panels. And we'll talk a little bit about the people on here and so forth.
Okay, thank you. So by way of sort of a historical background on Latinos in Michigan, some of you might be wondering how did these Latinos get to Michigan. As with many immigrants, the Latinos came for work reasons. So many of them worked in the railroad and construction and agricultural industry. In fact, in Michigan, Michigan was an early leader in the production of sugar beets in the early 1900s. So in that, around that time, there was a lot of expansion and construction, which required bringing laborers, low-wage laborers, to work the fields. By the 1920s, Mexican families comprised 75% of the sugar beet field labor in Michigan. That is quite a significant number of them. They were called, betabeleros, which is derived from the word betabel, which is the name for beetroot in Mexico. And they were actually earning lower wages because when they were brought here, their rail transportation was deducted from their wages. So that really decreased their earnings and opportunities. And so here we have a picture, a photograph of the interior of our house rented to Mexican workers by Michigan Sugar Company in Saginaw County, Michigan. As you see, it's quite modest, to put it mildly, but so not a lot of luxury, so very, very poor conditions. So in the 1920s, with all this agricultural immigration of Mexicans, also the Ford Motor Company was the largest employer of Mexicans. Some about 4,000 employees were from Mexican origin. Some of these men came from the fields, so they sort of settled out of the fields and left for factory floors where they had much better wages and opportunities, and others traveled specifically to work in the automotive industries. Yet others were called traqueros, which are railroad workers along the Michigan Central who also sought better wages. So a lot of this communication of opportunities happened through the migrant stream as well. Now, we're going to talk about now the union, UAW.
All of you know that the GM sit-down strike started at the close of 1936, and this had to do with a series of concerns regarding working conditions, employees not having the right to organize. We did not have the National Relations Labor Act, we had the Wagner Act, but it was not widely respected across the country and so forth. And workers were dying in some very hot conditions, working conditions. What is not known widely is the participation of Latinos in that strike. And we do know through this project, and I think something that was known locally by others who obviously were part of this, was the participation of Rafael Arceo, whose son is the person just walking out of the room right now, David Arceo, who will be in just a moment. But Rafael was a participant there and was a member of the construction crew that helped build the Fisher No. 1 plant, and in late 28 was hired to sand cars there at that Fisher plant. He is quoted as having said, "It was hell without a union. There was a time when I'd come home from work so tired I'd lie on the floor so my wife could feed me. I eat right there on the floor. There was no limits here to how many cars we'd send." I mean, it really was, this is a period of tremendous emphasis on worker productivity and no emphasis on worker rights or any of those kinds of things. The Taylorism really had a tremendous impact, and I think to some extent is part of how we design our workplaces and so forth today, but it doesn't surface as the philosophical, intellectual movement behind those designs. It just doesn't, it's just taken for granted these days. So here we have, that strike going on. Raul's father was also working for the GM at the time in the auto manufacturing sector, and participated, as Ralph has told me, in providing support to those who were sitting down by taking food, water, and other things. And I understand many of the women were actively participating in that kind of activity as well. So, you know, all of you know, it went for you know, a couple of months, and ultimately out of it, the UAW was able to consolidate its strength and to have the kind go on to have the kind of impact that we know it had during the second part of the 20th century. Rafael is recognized by the UAW over in Flint. They have a bust of him, and they also have a little brief biography of him. Who was he? Well, he was an 18-year-old who left his native state of Michoacán in Mexico, paid his $8 head tax to come into Texas, and in 28, as I mentioned, he was hired at Fisher No. 1, joined the union in 1936 because of the conditions, and throughout the strike, he stayed inside the plant in the daytime but went home at night to be with his sons and wife, who was pregnant at the time. During World War II, he worked long hours building tanks in Grand Blanc. Three generations of Arceos have worked for GM and have been strong UAW supporters. Rafael retired in September 1967. As I mentioned, David is also a retired auto worker, and his son is currently working in the industry in Indiana, is it? In Fort Wayne. So we have generations of auto workers. Other things, you know, so it raises the question, so were there other Latinos who participated in the strike? And I've asked that, and, you know, as I mentioned, I'm quite willing to manifest my ignorance openly, so I asked the question, were there some others? And the response has come back repeatedly. They weren't taking names for obvious reasons. Right? I mean, you didn't need to be known by name if you were going to be sitting in there because of the repercussions and so forth. So the documents and the records are really not there. So it has to occur through persons who knew who was in there, who participated, and so forth. There's also some other experiences that I've learned about. I just had Jose Angel Gutierrez here. He's a professor at UT Arlington, who tells me that his grandfather was killed in the riots at the Ford plants back in the 40s. So, you know, raises more questions. You know, why would a Latino be killed in a riot, and who was rioting, what was the issues about, and so forth. So those are the key questions that continue to emerge. Here's a bust of Rafael Arceo at the UAW Hall in Flint, Michigan. This was done when he was a senior, of course. But here's his certificate of naturalization that David was kind to share with me. And this is him when he was much younger, of course. He stood 5 feet, 8.5 inches tall, weighed 160 pounds, just like me, right? In Genesee County, so this is who he was. And that's probably close to what he looked like when he was sitting in the strike. This is a photo that was shared with me by Rafael. And these are Rafael's parents at their wedding, right? Does this have a pointer? Oh, there it is, yeah. This is Rafael Arceo over here and his wife. They were part of the wedding party, and this, I understand, took place in January of 1936, so about a year before the strike actually took place. So this gives you a little bit of the lives and family of Latinos in Flint in the 1930s. And this is Rafael and his spouse in their elder senior years. Okay? I'll pass it over to Daniel, who'll speak a little bit about Latino heritage and legacies.
Okay. Yes, so cultural heritage has been central. We found that cultural heritage has been central to many Latino families. As you may know, many Latinos are very family-oriented. And so many Latinos became Latino auto worker families. And so it sort of spread through family members, throughout they were actually the primary networks through which jobs in the auto industry were obtained. And so, as you've already heard a couple times, some of these Latino workers established family legacies that sustained generations of auto workers. And here we have a quote from Marta Milagros Bobillo, who's the lady over there on the banner, where she says, "My dad headed out of work one night, and he knew we were struggling financially. So I only live two blocks from Fisher Body, so my dad stopped by and told me, 'If you want to work at Fisher Body, even though I don't approve of you working there, they are taking applications right now.' So I walked over there early in the morning and walked in and put in my application, and a week later, I got hired." Then she says, "I'm very grateful to Fisher Body because we got there from Cuba. We got here from Cuba 3 days later. My dad was working there, so he got a job very soon. And we never had to be on welfare. We never had to ask nobody for money. Within 9 months after that, we owned our own house." So this speaks to the opportunities that were granted by having access to such high-paying jobs, and also coming from financial need. Which on the first quote there, looks like he didn't approve of her working there. Probably that was some also a cultural piece to that because of the gender role, because she was a female. And there were many other cases like this one where families were able to come from not having very much to attaining material things, such as a house or cars, but also they also attained status in the community, in their own communities, as a successful person. So they gained upward mobility. And here we have another quote from Sixto Olivo, where he says, "We got into the plant. Some of us were used to picking up the broom and cleaning and doing other things because our job went down. And people would say, 'No, there are lines of demarcation. You can't do that.' And we found ourselves very uncomfortable not doing something and getting paid for it because the work ethic that we learned coming from the fields where you always produce and you kept working all the time that you were getting paid." So here's another cultural contrast in terms of workforce, work culture, coming from the fields where people are always producing and idle time means loss of income. But in this environment, the jobs were so demarcated that they weren't used to that. And so to them, it felt very strange to be sitting doing nothing when the line was down or something like that.
This is Sixto.
Yeah, this
as is a Sixto. Much younger man, right?
My son.
And your son?
Much younger man, too.
Sixto stayed working and ultimately retired from the auto industry, but he also at some point became a businessman. He got into the supply chain and owned a business producing batteries as part of the chain, became a prominent person in Flint, serving on many boards and commissions and so on, doing his civic duty and civic engagement and all of that. And so here he was recognized by one of the Flint publications by having him on the front cover in 1995. And this is what he looked like a couple of months ago when I visited him, and he was very generous with his time and talking about the his experiences and so forth.
Okay, so along with efforts to integrate into the workplace, where they were minority, ethnic tensions naturally occurred or arose and also shaped their experiences in the automotive industry. So there were cases of both individual and structural discrimination. But Latino workers sometimes felt marginalized and excluded from work-based opportunities due to gender, racial, and language distinction. One example for language discrimination was that one of the former auto workers we interviewed shared that speaking English with less of an accent meant having better opportunities and being treated better. Where people that had a thicker accent and were not so good with English were actually sometimes made fun of. So here's another example of individual levels discrimination shared by Marta Bovillo. One of the supervisors, when I got there, he said, "I asked for somebody. I didn't ask for a kid." And my supervisor that came with me said, "She might look like a kid, but she works like a man." So you have to prove yourself all the time. I feel like I earned this respect. And so she is very petite, so that's where the kid reference comes from, because they saw that she was very petite and a female, but didn't think she was up to the task. But definitely, gladly, she proved them wrong. So there was some gender-based discrimination there. And another quote showing more of a structural type of discrimination shared by Sixto Olivo. In the skilled trades area, there was resistance by the old journeymen that were there that saw us as a threat. And once again, the inherent feeling by some, regardless whether they're skilled tradesmen, salary workers, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, whatever, the inherent feeling is that this man of color is jeopardizing me by coming to my area that has been exclusively mine. Some of them had accomplished their positions by virtue of having been there when the opportunity was there, not because they were so inherently qualified to be there, but they were there when the jobs were not being opened to us. So definitely this speaks to the limited opportunities due to access and structural factors not being offered the positions. And you know, this argument they're here to take my position or my work, we still hear it today, you know, with a lot of these when we hear comments on immigration and jobs. So they're coming to take our jobs. So that's sort of the fear in that creates these structural barriers.
A couple of things about Marta Bovillo. When she started working there, one of the great joys on the line, at least among the men, was whenever she would go to the bathroom, they would go over to her station and hide her tools, right? And then she'd come back and spend whatever amount of time floundering while they laughed at her and made fun and so forth. But ultimately, that ended as well, you know, once she's recognized as a good worker and one of them. So you have to wonder also, when the father says, "I don't really want you going to work there," whether it's really a matter of cultural practice of, you know, the woman not working outside of the home, or whether he knew very well how women would be treated on the line. once they got there. And I think it probably was a combination of both. I mean, fathers are obviously very protective as well, and he knew what would happen. But she survived it. Not only did she survive it, but she went on to be the first woman elected to the executive board of her local, okay, and still has tremendous influence there, even though she is petite, small, she's very powerful in her presence and in the work that she does. As Daniel mentioned, we have legacies of Latino Otto families, right? We have the Arceo family, but we also have the Reyes family. Your Aunt Reyes, his grandfather worked for the union. He tells the story about how his grandfather worked in the foundries and mentions that, well, this is where African-Americans and Latinos worked, right? So over time, the next generation begins to move up. His father, I believe, becomes a journeyman painter. The grandson, he himself moves on up, and now he has a son finishing up at Harvard. So you can see really that upward social mobility that takes place, and it comes from a couple of things. One, having a stable income, and secondly, being part of what I call the Cadillac labor force, right? And by that, I don't mean that they're making Cadillacs. I mean they're the top of the line of the blue-collar labor force. So in terms of the bonds and barriers, what Art has to say, and Art is the former president of the UAW local in 651 in Flint. He has a brother who is currently a president of one of the other locals. And so over generations, the family has become very active and involved in leadership roles. But his view here in this regard has to do with the barriers. I don't believe in patronage. I was never part of the old boy network, and I think there was a racial component to that, but it was never anything overt. I was never brought into that inner circle. I always had to run against that old boy network. I was never anybody's golfing buddy or fishing buddy. I was never invited to those circles, right? So it's actually through exclusion that many of these things take place. I remember when I got my first job in academia, I had a fellow who had an office next to me, and he never said boo to me for the first 5 years that we were office neighbors, okay? I mean, I'd be coming out to go to lunch, he'd be coming out to go to lunch, and he'd just walk right past me as if I didn't even exist. And this is what he's talking about. It doesn't only occur in the blue-collar sector, it occurs all the way to the top, right? That's what gender bias and racial bias and ethnic bias is all about, is that it's complete, right? So it doesn't matter. I mean, Obama could drive a vehicle to a gas station and maybe get very poor service just because nobody recognizes him.
Ralph, as they call him. All the time.
Thank you.
They were married for 70 years.
So this is Art. And so, you know, the previous course really was to give you some sense of the experience that he was having, that he had. He is on the line. Workers' rights are human rights. I think that's one of the most contemporary slogans in the labor movement today, is that labor rights are regarded as human rights. And then we turn to the issue of opportunity and identity.
Right. So at various levels, Latinos found opportunities for incorporation and advancement through the United Automobile Workers. So the union sort of became a means to advance and promote equity. So many Latino workers gain understanding of their own potential through committee work and union activities, assuming positions of leadership. They also obtain training and education opportunities through the union. So unions became platforms from which to reach out to other workers, including Latinos, and as a way of giving back to the worker, to the workplace, and strengthening their own communities. Sometimes through community outreach projects or events, as well as campaigning for other Latinos to become officials. And so here's another union as a family, or another theme of the family, quote by Marta Bobillo. To me, it's like a family, my union at Fisher Body is like a family. Even if we don't see each other, we still have each other in each other's heart and think about each other. So this definitely was a resounding message, not just with her, but with others, other former auto workers. And here we have a photo of Marta, if you can point, yeah, she's on the far right here. And her mother, and her daughter, and granddaughter.
Four generations. And this pose, any of you recognize this pose that she's taking here? It's from Rosie the Riveter. And some of you may know that she lived here most of her life, here in Lansing. I think Marta tells the story of having gone to some union convention in Nevada, and with other women that were there, they talked about Rosie the Riveter, and then they decided to locate her, and she was surprised that she lived right here in her own town. They contacted her and had communications and, if you will, relations with her till she passed away. But because of this photo, guess who poses in that manner these days?
Yeah, this was at the exhibit that is available. It's downstairs. You're welcome to go see it. And so here we have another quote from Rudolfo Reyes. And this one talks about opportunities, but also about identity. So I have a lot of good union experiences. The union has, to put it bluntly, spent a lot of money on me. But in reverse, I hope I've given at least that much back, because they educated me, they sent me places, they showed me things that I had never had the opportunity to do, to sit on boards. I had the opportunity to represent labor. I've been in the newspaper many times, but a lot of people forget that when they put my name in the newspaper, it says Arturo Reyes, Local 602 Community Service Chairperson, because that is who I represent when I sit on the board. I usually represent labor. 99% of my time, of the time I'm in labor, and if I'm not, or I am labor, sorry. And if I'm not, I'm associated with labor.
And that should be Rodolfo there instead of Arturo.
It's Rodolfo, yes. And that is the gentleman on the far left. That's Rodolfo Reyes. Also at the exhibit with Nino Rodriguez and Mayor Hollister. Also at the exhibit. And here we hear from Michael Huerta, going a little bit even beyond identity. He says, I don't have to go to my union meetings, but I want to. I like the people who show up at the meetings. I like the leadership we currently have. I went to the union meetings under the leadership we previously had, who I had a lot of problems with, but it didn't matter. It's my union. It's my union. I'm responsible. Same way I get very involved in local politics and city politics and national politics. This is my country. I have an obligation. So taking ownership of being a union member and not being swayed by whether he likes the leadership or not, but this is, he says, it's my union. And sort of also being given an opportunity to sit on boards and having that ownership has led him to also become civically engaged in outside of the union in politics at the national level and the local level.
Here we talk a little bit about leadership roles because Art Reyes was a president, twice elected to office with Local 651. And it speaks, I think, to the kinds of perspectives that minority persons, including women, bring to positions of leadership because of what they've experienced, what they know the group that they belong to has experienced. I think they bring a different kind of perspective. And here is his. When I was president of my local union, I wanted my members to look at their appointed staff, the bureaucracy of the union, and see somebody that looks like them. I encouraged people of color and females, supported their run for office. My first fully elected term as president, the three other officers were female, two Latinas and a white woman, and myself. I made a great effort to get these things done. When I appointed people, I took those things into consideration. I think that's a perspective very different from what is typically regarded as the old boy network. That doesn't mean that every white male holds the old boy network perspective, but it does mean that those are the structural levels and activities that occur out there. And as a result, some people are insiders and other people are outsiders, right? And here is Art, when he was president, giving a presentation. He lost his election earlier this spring, and he was, this summer when I talked to him, he was in between positions because he had been representing a union of retired workers. So he really didn't have a position in the plant because of that role. And so when he got beat out at the last election, he didn't have a position to go to. So he was in transition when I visited with him, and I think it took him about 2 months to get into another position, and now because he's the low man on the totem pole, he has a lot less flexibility about in terms of moving around and getting out to events. But that's him when he was in this transition period. Where are we with this project? Several things come to mind. One, there's so much more work to be done. I mean, this project, that as we have produced it up to this point, took about a year to produce. Okay, there are so many more oral history interviews that need to be conducted, and I've got a list of people that, if I had more time, I'd actually get out in the field and do more of these. And I know that there are many more instances and examples of the kind of experiences that they have had. So using these oral history interviews, I think we could identify and organize more themes than we have to this point. There's more artifact collections. You will see if you go downstairs that we do have some artifacts from the workplace that people have shared with us. The other piece that I wanted done was for the auto workers themselves, or retired auto workers, to write short pieces, short stories on the experiences, because I wanted them to, you know, state it in their own voice. And I do have a couple of them. But in working, first of all, not having done an exhibit before, and in working with the experts here at the museum, they told me that, you know, we don't really use long narratives. Because people come, they want to see things, you know, and they want to read something short and so forth. And so I might do something like a collection of short stories that can be made available, because I think they have something to say, and I have actually obtained a few, and I think there are many more that can be obtained. We've only begun to, you know, really see the tip of the iceberg when it comes to photographs. I've wanted to particularly get photographs within the plant. And of course, you know, there are some issues there because of the intellectual property, so to speak, about production and so forth. But there are some that are there. I mean, I'm not sure how what was going on, but, you know, that first one on the cover, that's Nacho Trigo in 1966, is working in the plant. He's a happy worker. But, you know, these things did occur. So we're going to continue to do that work. And, you know, in conclusion, before we open it up for questions, I want to thank the Latino Auto Workers Committee members. That was Ralph Sixto. We had Rudy Reyes. We had Elisa Gurule. Ultimately, David joined us as well. Laura Helu from here at the museum, who really supported us. John Beck, who turned us on to Motor Cities Area National Heritage Area Foundation, which funded some of this project for us, particularly the production of these items that will be used as part of the exhibit, also gave us the idea of making it into a traveling exhibit so that we can have it rotated, right? So it'll be easy to do that. And I just got back, thanks to the airlines, very late last night from Washington, D.C., where I met with, we have a national consortium of Latino research centers across the country. We have about 25 member units, and I met with about 18 of them yesterday and the day before. And down at UT Austin, there are a couple of new leaders there. One, they've separated Mexican-American studies into a research center and into an academic program, and they're getting ready to inaugurate that. I don't know if we would call it separation, but the establishment of the new unit. And I had mentioned to them that we had done this work, and so they wanted to take the exhibit down there and use it as part of the inaugural opening of the unit. And basically, they were fascinated by the whole story, right? So we're hoping that there will be more interest. We know that we're going to be working with museums here in Michigan to have this rotated and hopefully add more items to it as we go along. But I want to thank John for the support that he has provided and the connections that he's provided. Shirley Vida, who is sitting in the back, she's a new member of the museum here. I think she's been here less than a year, right? And she didn't know what she was getting into, but she has embraced the project. She recognizes the importance of it. She's an American studies scholar, historian, and particularly in local history. And she sees the immense potential of this project, has embraced it with us, and we're looking forward to working with her to identify more funds and to expand the project so that we cover more of it and have a an expanded outcome in terms of the exhibit and so forth. Her colleague, Teresa Goforth, also a new member here, she helped us with the designs and putting together a lot of the materials. She also was relatively new, but she jumped into it. Ralph Ariano, retired educator, Ruri Reyes, David Arceo, John Martinez, who wrote some short stories for me. He was he's with Local 22 over in the Dearborn area and has written several short pieces. He was the editor of their newsletter, so he likes to do that kind of work already. Maria Enriquez, who works for the government here, but she's a union leader and activist and promoter. She helped me identify some works early on. The interviewee, Sixto Olivo, Marta Bovillo, Art Reyes. I also want to thank the Motor Cities Automobile National Heritage Area Foundation for the support. And John Beck turned me on to the digital exhibit that's on the Lansing Auto Town Gallery in the G. Robert Vincent Voice Library here at Michigan State. And I think when they closed Fisher Body here, they did, over 100, 125 interviews that were done by members of the union themselves and so on. And they had some photos and some notes from the interviews and in some instances other items, maybe a photograph and so on. So I went through the whole 125 and found, I think, 7 who were Latinos, right? So that served as material, right? So I'm very thankful to them for that work. And there have been many others who have provided ideas, referrals, and so on, who contributed to the project, and we're very grateful to that. The exhibit is downstairs. It's a small exhibit at this point, but as I mentioned, we want to expand it. It will be there. Well, initially it was going to be there from October 24th through, I think, December 21st, but now we've extended the timeline and we'll go into about January 21st or something like that. So that will give people a little more time. We hope that you will take time to go through it and also let others know so that they can also enjoy the exhibit. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do is have the two of you work off of this microphone, and I'm going to take that one around. So if you have comments, especially those of you who have personal stories, we'd love to make sure that those are on tape. So I'll just give that one, and you guys can do a duet.
All right.
So if you have questions or comments, please raise your hand, and I'll come around and give you the microphone. Okay.
Thank you. The one, Doctor, with reference just to talk to you about three generations. In our home, with Mom and Dad, you never heard the word of quit at school, that you were going to quit or you were just going to go to the 9th grade or whatever. You were going to finish and you were going to graduate, period. You weren't about to argue with Mom. With that, having said that, out of the 13 grandchildren, 8 of the grandchildren went on to do an undergrad, and now they're into the business communities. Granted that Dad was a sit-downer, and it's interesting that out of the 13, only one, that's Paul, that's one that's in Fort Wayne, stayed with the industry, stayed as an assembly person. But to me, that's education. Education is the real key. Ralph Ariano, I'll tell you right now, was one of the first, because we had a small community, was one of the first to move on, graduated from high school, and then went on to do graduation. Ariano was it. That was the key with reference to that one. But that there is really the solution in order to move forward for the standard of living that we want for our children and our children's children. Thank you.
Let me just ask you a quick question and then see if I can get some other hands in the air. Tell us a little bit about how much return migration do we know about in the Lansing community or the other Latino autoworker communities in terms of how much continued linkage with the Southwest, with Texas, with areas of Mexico and everything else. Did you run into any of that in your work as you were talking to Art or Marta or the rest?
Yeah, my sense is that there's very limited amounts of return migration. I mean, historically, there have been these repatriation movements and so forth. But once individual families settled up here, they tended to stay. And I think to some extent it had to do with the opportunities that were available here. Again, you know, there was this economic expansion and so on that was going on. But there's not as much as you would find today in the African-American community. I mean, you have a lot of out-migration by African-Americans, particularly in the Detroit area, who have moved to the south. You do have, you know, as I say, I'm not a Tejano, I'm a Manito from New Mexico, and I'd like to say that, you know, Tejanos to a great extent are always trying to return to Texas. So there's some amount of that has occurred. But by and large, the Latino Mexican-American community in particular has tended to stay here. The Cuban community, you know, many of those who came through the, Pedro Pan program in the early 60s, they worked here, they retired, but many of them moved to Miami, where you have much higher concentrations. And I know that the Puerto Rican communities were migrant communities initially when they came. They're not as large either. I think they also moved to some other parts in the Midwest. You have some high concentrations in Cleveland. You have high concentrations in Chicago and some of these other communities. But it's not, I mean, you find some of it, but it's not as large as you would find in other communities.
Well, I can only speak to my own experience. My father took me back to Michoacan when I was 5 years old. It was a four-day trip on the train, which I still have some memories of it. We've always been in contact. I have all my father had two brothers and a sister, which I became familiar with over the years. When my children were born, from the time they were 1 year old or so, I took my children back to visit. And they have their own experiences and their own friends down there. So half of the cousins moved to Chicago, and there is a back and forth. So in my family, we have a strong connection with Michoacan. I personally have traveled, I've probably driven 100,000 miles in Mexico. But I think that there's virtually a pride in that Mexican heritage, but many, many people that I know have never been there. Many Latinos, many Mexican Americans have not been back to Mexico, unless they've gone to Cancun or Puerto Vallarta, you know. Acapulco, yeah, that sort of thing. But I don't see a great deal of migration back, although, as Ruben said, we were just talking with a friend who's thinking about moving back to Texas. There is, you know, quite a bit of visiting back and forth to Texas relatives that I know of. We did have a couple of, one, two, three, about four folks that we brought up from, with our first affirmative action, we brought up from New Mexico, Las Cruces. And they're still around. I don't know if they go back and forth much or not, but there has been some movement that I know of, but not a lot.
What's interesting, too, is that, you know, South Texas, where many of the Mexican-Americans here are from, has some very strong currents in terms of racial dynamics. So if you got out of there and you were raised outside of that arena and you're not accustomed to the racial norms of living there, going back is very difficult, so that they can't get accustomed to it. You know, I have colleagues who come out of there, who were raised there, they got out, you know, not necessarily to get out, but, you know, through education and worked elsewhere and so forth, and they go back and they really cannot fit within the racial norms of that region anymore. And I think by people haven't been raised here, I mean, there's not that there's an absence of racial dynamics here, but they're different, And these are the ones they know, and the ones that are down there, they're different, and they're, I think, a little more constraining, if you will. And so it makes it difficult for them to settle into those norms. David, you had a comment?
In the murals by Diego Rivera in the Detroit Institute of Art, in the very large one of the factory, in the foreground, I think at least one of the men portrayed is a Latino, at least one. And Rivera did go out to the factories and get some ideas. And that was 1932 for that mural. So a few years later, when the economy was very, very down, it's reported in the literature that he helped to pay some of these Mexicans for their transport back to Mexico because they couldn't get anything else to do.
Thank you for that comment. And that I hadn't heard that, but I don't discount it. The other thing to keep in mind is that there were some very powerful repatriation movements in the 30s and the 50s and... Well, we all know of the, what is it, self-deportation movement, that they, as they call it today. Those are repatriation movements as well. So the dynamic between Mexican labor and the United States has been one where bring them in when you need them and take them out when you don't need them anymore. And it's difficult to say just exactly where we are today because there's a great demand for that kind of labor, certainly not taking anybody's labor work opportunities away, because when they've tried to bring in American workers into the fields in Georgia and California and so forth, I mean they didn't last more than 2 or 3 days because it's very, very difficult work. But thank you for that comment.
Well, and just to underline it, Dorothy's correct. Diego Rivera actually was trying to set up, believe. In eastern Mexico, a Monterrey area or whatever, an actual kind of colony, in effect, of not necessarily formal repatriados, but of a number of people that he was trying to get to move down. And the notion was that they were actually trying to start an industrial area that Rivera was pushing during that time frame. So, indeed, that was definitely going on.
There's another dimension here, too, and that is that for several decades, Mexico has been sending engineers up here. And they are part of the Detroit plants and so forth. I don't know, Sixto, if they were over in Flint and in those areas. But there's a community of them. You know, they come, they stay for a certain amount of time. It's an extended period of time. I mean, it's not like they come up for a week or something. They come and they work here, and they have these communities. But I don't think they're very much embedded in the larger Latino communities here. I mean, they stay pretty much to themselves, they're professionals and so forth. And, you know, Mexico still is a very hierarchical society, but they are here. And I think that aspect hasn't been studied or very little has been focused on. And it'd be interesting to see what the relations are between that community and the community of, say, native-born or native workers or workers who stayed here as blue-collar workers.
Any other questions or comments from the audience? Just raise your hand. Any others? Why don't we give Daniel and Ruben another round of applause?
Thank you.
Now, let me again announce that next Friday, same place, we'll have a talk about the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the effect of that on affirmative action in the construction industry. That's the last brown bag of this calendar year and of the semester, but we'll start again next January. So please do sign in, and I can add you to our list. And I want to thank everybody today, especially all of you who had a hand in the wonderful exhibit downstairs. I'm going to ask that perhaps Ruben and Daniel might make themselves available down in the exhibit if any of you are interested in finding out more about it or have any questions. I can put them on that hook, but not before they sign the release sheet that allows us to put their information up on the web. So thank you so much for coming, and we'll see you next time here at our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.